loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, it's Election Day in the United States today for the House, the Senate, and for many governor's races and municipal elections. We'll talk about the significance or possible significance of these elections on the politics of the United States going forward. And then we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday. It's called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, on the eve of the midterm election, Facebook announced that it had conducted another round of account deletions. How have social media purges and constant stories about foreign interference impacted the political climate leading up to polling day? Next, thousands of migrants from Central America are making the perilous journey north, fleeing violence, poverty, and political repression. Donald Trump has made the caravan the top issue in the midterm election, whipping up anti-immigrant sentiment and talking about an invasion. But who really are the people who make up the caravan? Then, the harshest U.S. sanctions yet have been imposed on Iran, targeting the country's crucial oil sector. World leaders are expressing their frustration with U.S. unilateralism, but the economic pressure on the country continues to mount. And then, three Venezuelan guards were killed along the border with Colombia this weekend by an armed group. This comes just days after U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton declared support for far-right Colombian President Iván Duque, while naming Venezuela as part of the, quote, Troika of Terror. And finally, last week on Loud and Clear, we talked about the Human Rights Watch report that featured North Korean defectors alleging sexual abuse in North Korea. Today, we're joined again by Dr. Christine Hong to rebut these allegations and discuss how South Korean and other intelligence agencies use defectors to further a narrative aimed at disrupting steps towards peace and reunification. And in other headlines, lawyers for imprisoned former Brazilian President Lula da Silva have filed a new motion in court today seeking his release. The legal team is basing their habeas corpus request on the fact that the official who prosecuted Lula, Sergio Moro, has been announced as the justice minister for the incoming far-right administration of Jair Bolsonaro. Lula's lawyers argue that this shows a clear political motivation to Moro's prosecution. A new United Nations report has shed new light onto the extent of atrocities committed by ISIS in Iraq. 202 mass graves have been discovered in areas formerly controlled by the group. Thousands of victims' remains are in them. A 94-year-old Nazi SS camp guard went on trial today with hundreds of charges of accessory to murder. He was a concentration camp guard at Stutthof. Over 60,000 people were killed at that concentration camp. Cesar Sayoc, the man accused of recently mailing pipe bombs to high-profile officials and former government officials and CNN, appeared in a New York court today and was held without bail. The 56-year-old was in court for just a few minutes and did not fight the decision. He was arrested on October 26th. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the midterm elections. As we speak, millions of people across the country are lining up to vote in crucial local, state, and federal elections, as well as a number of important referendums. What's at stake in the midterm elections, and how will it affect the direction of the country? We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, the co-directors of Popular Resistance, and from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch. He is also a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon. Kevin, Margaret, Dave, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Margaret Flowers, let's start with you. Many times throughout history, even recent history, people can talk about the big problem facing people who want to do political activism is the problem of apathy or perceived apathy, meaning people just don't seem to care that much about politics. That's not true right now. There's a huge amount of political engagement for the Democratic Party, for the Republican Party, for people by people who support Trump or those who are voting for Democrats mainly as a referendum of opposition against Donald Trump. There is a lot of engagement. end of the day, though, depending on what happens with this election, whether the Republicans or the Democrats control the Senate and the House, what are the big issues that are likely to be impacted in the coming sort of legislative calendar?
So overall, I'm sure you know, Brian, that we're not going to see a big difference, you know, whether it's the Republicans that remain in power or the Democrats who remain in power. They operate within a very narrow framework of, you know, domestic and foreign policy. Both parties support war. They support imperialism. They support economic policies that benefit the wealthy and, you know, not the rest of the population. What we're hearing from the Democrats, and of course, it's a campaign time. So, you know, we'll have to see how they behave after the elections, is that they are going to possibly move more on a national improved Medicare for all proposal. You know, we have legislation in the House and in the Senate, and they're saying that, well, if we take back the House, then we'll start moving on that. That reason that they're saying that is because there is a strong movement for national improved Medicare for all. And we have a lot of work to do, even if they do move on it, because they're more likely to try to water it down and turn it into something that sounds like Medicare for all, but still benefits the Wall Streeters. So at the end of the day, it's you know, voting is one thing that we do, but it doesn't make as big a difference as the other work that we do in activism and movement building.
Dave Lindorf, there's been a huge volume of early voting, far beyond anything that's happened in the past, certainly in a midterm elections. Again, people are activated. They care. They're hoping that what they do at the polls will make a difference. In terms of the races that you're looking at today, let's just focus a little bit on the House. Do you expect the Democrats to win the House of Representatives? They would need to pick up 23 net seats. And if so, will there be a, quote, Democratic Party agenda along the lines of healthcare that will be implemented?
Well, that's two questions. Let's first correct the record here. I will quote Yogi Berra, who said that predictions are hard to make, especially about the future.
That was Casey Stengel, by the way, not Yogi Berra.
It was Yogi Berra. I looked it up.
That's fake news. That's fake news.
Whoever it is, it was definitely a salient point, and I have no idea other than that to say that, you know, all the polls I'm reading are saying that it's very likely that the Democrats will at least squeak in with the majority and maybe get a, you know, 20 cushion of a majority in the House. But having said that, you know, just looking at your healthcare issue, which is one I've written about for years, even if they win the Senate, and that's a much iffier question, but let's say they did. Let's say that Beto O'Rourke pulls off a squeaker and that Heitkamp somehow survives in North Dakota and nobody else goes down, or she goes down and nobody else goes down in a tight Democratic race. So this, you have the Senate in Democratic hands too. First of all, the Senate, a bunch of Democrats coming in, it would be, you know, it would require, I guess, that guy Breeden or whatever in Tennessee winning, who's almost a Republican, and the guy running in Indiana, who's almost a Republican, who is a Republican with a Democratic nameplate, and some others, the guy in Alabama. You know, you've got a lot of Democratic senators who really are Republicans, so you're not going to get 51 votes on a health care bill from those guys.
Let's get Kevin Zeese in there. Kevin, it's true what Dave Lindorf is saying. A great number of the candidates who are running in districts, say congressional districts, that were formerly Republican, maybe voted for Hillary Clinton, or they were kind of toss-up areas. The candidates, many of them who are running, are pretty right-wing, connected to the military, connected to intelligence services. If elected, would they constitute some sort of a sharp departure from what we see now?
Oh, no, not a sharp departure at all. But I think what you'd see would be on the House, you'll see more conflict between the White House and with the president, and you'll see more investigations, and that'll become the focus of the news, and that's where our attention will be gathered. The Senate goes Democrat. I think the major thing you'll see that'll change will be the judiciary. You'll stop seeing this rush to right-wing judges, and maybe some more moderation, but if not, some blocking of more of a right wing corporate court system that we've been developing under Mitch McConnell's leadership with Donald Trump's help. So those are the changes I'd see. Otherwise, I think it's as stay as you go as far as wars go. We may see something with Yemen. The recent killing of the journalist by Saudi Arabia has put Yemen on the map, has put the leadership of the prince on the map. And so Yemen is pretty ugly, and we may see some changes there finally. But other than that, I expect to see more of the same, more Russiagate, more stalemate between Russia and the United States, more war games, more threats, and more militarism. So basically the same path with different colored people, reds and blues, playing different roles.
Margaret, the amount of money spent on the election, the midterms, is $5.2 billion. $5.2 billion on midterms. This is not the presidential election campaign. You look at Texas, the number I think is $118 million for that one Senate seat, where Beto O'Rourke has spent $69 million. He's about doubled the spending for Ted Cruz. Again, once, let's say, Beto O'Rourke, who's considered, you know, it's something, he's a Democrat, he's not right wing, he's running in Texas, should he win, people, liberals will be celebrating, the Democrats will be celebrating, they're going to think a new blue wave is coming, if not now, soon. Again, though, let's talk about policy. If Beto O'Rourke comes in, based on some of his statements, at least, it seems to me that he would be trying to find common ground, not like a militant opposition to the Donald Trump program, at least on some levels. Anyway, what's your take on that stuff?
Well, you know, it's interesting how that more and more money is being thrown at these elections, and that's because the wealthy in this country reap a tremendous benefit by being able to select with their dollars who ends up, you know, winding up in Congress. As far as progressive policies go, you know, the trouble is that people who get into office have to stay in office. And in order to be able to stay in office, they can't make too many waves. If they want to get on committee positions, they can't make too many waves. So we often see people who run on progressive sounding platforms, but once they actually get into Congress and have to deal with the realities, they either go along to get along, or they get marginalized and redistricted, or spent out in the next race. So, that's just why we keep returning to the idea that listeners need to understand, is that we support voting, but to think that voting is actually what's going to make the difference in changing the course of the way our country is going, it's not. The real reality is that we have to mobilize, educate ourselves about the issues and mobilize around them. And when we do that, that's when, you know, people in power, people like Donald Trump, who, after we built a strong movement to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership, rode that wave and actually stopped the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, of course, he's working on other rigged corporate trade deals, but it was a movement victory that happened.
Go ahead, Dave.
I would just say that there is a tendency to paint all Democrats with the same brush in terms of corporatists, and there is some difference. I'm thinking of, Ocasio-Cortez in Brooklyn won her primary on something like $100,000. And small money, and as far as I know, didn't take any corporate money running in the general election either. And Beto O'Rourke also is interesting because he didn't take any PAC money, and most of that money that he got was sort of Sanders-like, in small donations. So, he's got, if you assumed that he won, he'd be winning without owing any big corporations money or any big blocks of money. And the other thing is, with respect to what Margaret said, which is absolutely true, that, you got to go along to get committee assignments and stuff. I'll tell you that if O'Rourke were to win and it had to be the seat that gave the Senate to the Democrats, he pretty much would own the place for Democrats. I don't think he'd have any trouble getting on the committee he wanted. But that's a pipe dream, actually. But I'm just saying that there are exceptions to the rule. And both of those candidates, by the way, have made statements about the absurd U.S. foreign policies of wars and the size of the defense budget. So that's encouraging, at least.
Kevin Zeese, go ahead.
I'm also encouraged by that. I mean, what you're seeing is the political movement, the popular movement, is changing the political dialogue in the country. There's obviously a right-wing movement, and there's also a progressive left-wing movement. And we're changing the dialogue. And it's as a result, that's beginning to be reflected in elected officials. I mean, I don't work on Democrat or Republican campaigns, but I do see elections as a tool, and I'm pleased to see more Democrats feeling like they have to support Medicare for All. It's now a record number in the House, record number in the Senate. More of the Democrats who want to run for president are talking about Medicare, improved Medicare for All. We have to keep them honest on that, but that's a very positive. But that's because there's a political movement. The political movement has changed the narrative, and that changes the political culture, and the elected officials need to adapt to that. And so if Beto wins, I think you're right, Dave. I think he would own the place, because that winning Texas and defeating Cruz, who came in second in the presidential race, would be huge. I don't know if it's going to happen, but if he does, he will really be in a very strong position to get what he wants in the Senate.
I would say one other thing, just that's sort of anecdotal, but I have a 25-year-old son. He's an Asian kid ethnically. We adopted in Hong Kong, and he's now a videographer down in Baltimore. And he was telling me that his friends in Philadelphia, where he went to school, public school, and in New York, because he's a B-boy, you know, goes to B-boy dances and has a lot of friends in that movement. He said everybody's voting in that millennial age group, and they're voting left. And he said, Dad, we're all anarchists or socialists. And, you know, that you didn't used to hear. And I think it is true. Polls are saying that too. So there is something happening out there, and you know, it may benefit Democrats right now, but I think more long term, it bodes well for the chances of movement politics. And I think back to when I was wearing going out with a jacket and clean for Gene, you know, before becoming serious anti-war militant. The first step is sometimes a small one, you know.
Okay, well, that's an important factor, certainly. Everybody who eventually becomes a political radical, probably, depending on who their parents were, didn't start off as a political radical. You, Margaret, you sort of move as you go through a set of experiences, you learn more and more, and you learn that the problem isn't this or that bad politician. The problem really is the system. And then you try the line of least resistance in terms of how to change the system that might be voting. That doesn't work. At the end of the day, the Democrats and the Republicans endorse the same military budget, you know, almost really about $1 trillion when you look at all the spending for all of these wars of empires and occupations and military installations. And then you take the next step and you become a more radical. That is true. That is a process. But then there's the other part of it, Margaret, and I want you to talk about this kind of dichotomy. When we were talking about Ocasio-Cortez, she's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America running in the 14th Congressional District in New York, which straddles Queens and the Bronx. When she won, after she won the nomination, when she was on firing line because she had earlier denounced Israel's massacre of Palestinians, they said, "What's your position on Israel?" And she responded, "I believe absolutely in Israel's right to exist. I am a proponent of a two-state solution." The candidate said her previous position about Gaza, the clashes that led to the Israeli massacre, quote, was not a referendum on the state of Israel. In other words, serious backtracking on an earlier position that she had as a political activist. The tendency, the pressure on people who actually make it into the seats of power or seats of representation is such that unless you're a remarkably strong, clear, committed person, the tendency is for people to move to the right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Absolutely. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders is a case in point. He started out as pretty radical when he was mayor of Burlington. And as he's moved more and more into the Democratic Party and into a position of leadership, you know, when push comes to shove, he's more likely to compromise than he is to really, you know, he says a lot of good things, but when it comes down to actually the policy, you know, he does tend to compromise in ways that undermine what we're trying to achieve. So just for example, if we look at his healthcare legislation, people within the movement for a national improved Medicare for All system really pushed on him after he was elected to introduce legislation that was the same as what we have had in the House for 15 years, a very strong piece of legislation that was crafted by organizations like Physicians for a National Health Program that are the health policy experts on this issue. He refused to do that and instead compromised such a piece of legislation that, in fact, if it was to be, you know, passed and implemented, would not be a single-payer healthcare system and would be a huge profit maker for the medical industry. So, you know, we have to recognize that, like you said, that power is only useful if the person who holds it is willing to use it in a positive and constructive way. And there is such a tendency because of all the backroom deals and the politicking that goes on for people once they're in there to begin that course of compromising. And I think people do tell themselves, well, I have to compromise in order to hopefully do something positive. You know, I'll make these small gains. And that, unfortunately, just isn't enough for meeting people's needs or addressing the climate crisis or this huge, you know, empire in decline that we're experiencing right now and a growing military budget that's taking away from our social programs. You know, we need bigger solutions. We need bolder people in power.
That's the voice of Margaret Flowers. She's a co-director of Popular Resistance. You can read her writings and the writings of our other guest, Kevin Zeese, at popularresistance.org. We're also joined by journalist and author Dave Lindorf. Dave, right now, Donald Trump, he could be talking almost exclusively about the economy. Unemployment is at a historic low. The stock market is booming. Corporate earnings are high. Instead, he's like bashing immigrants. He sends 15,000 troops to stop the caravan. We're going to talk later today with Gloria Lariva, who's with the caravan coming up through Mexico. These are poor people. Why does Donald Trump focus so much on this anti-immigrant, this immigrant bashing campaign, when he could be speaking just about how great the economy is and taking credit falsely for whatever good things are happening in the economy? And there's many bad things that are also happening at the same time. But why take this particular tact? What's Trump's idea here? Because obviously, it's also alienating a lot of, say, suburban Republican voters who might vote for Republicans normally, but are turned off by this kind of extreme racism and xenophobia.
Yeah. By the way, I know it's radio, so you can't put quotes, you can't say quotes, but the caravan is really a right-wing term for what this is. It's a march. You know, it's a trek. The caravan term has the image of Arabs in the desert, and it was carefully chosen, and everybody's using it. And I just want to stick that out there. It's not a caravan, but you're right. It's just poor people, and he's chosen very cleverly chosen this particular image that appeals to his hardcore base of racists.
And that's what I'm asking. Is it clever or is it the opposite?
Yeah, I think he's clever because it has worked for him to get his base out there really rabid and ready to vote. And so if he does that and Democrats don't manage to drive people to the polls with a great deal of enthusiasm, he wins. But it may not work if the Democrats are more inspired.
Let's go to Kevin. Go ahead, Kevin.
We'll see tonight whether or not it was a good gamble on his part. You're right. It could turn off a lot of voters in the suburbs, which really is the battleground between the two parties. It could generate, you know, people showing up from his extreme base. And it could also get Democrats angry because it's so extreme and so false. The information out there on this migrant march really shows the false nature of it. These marchers are over a thousand miles away from the border. You're talking about 15,000 troops now, raising questions about the use of the military and domestic law enforcement. Is that even legal?
Not to mention the vigilantes, too, it's attracted.
Oh, exactly. And I'm not sure whether the vigilante story is even true or not, but that's out there. And we'll see if that's true. But so it's a very dangerous path. It's the typical divide and rule mentality, turning poor whites against poor people of color. The reality is the enemy is the same. It's the top 0.1% who are getting wealthier by the minute as the rest of the country and as these immigrants are getting poorer. It's, you know, so it's a great divide and rule tactic. I hope it backfires. I hope there's enough information out there. This is a false fear. But we'll see tonight whether or not suburban voters are going with Trump or going against him on this.
Yeah. And Margaret Flowers, we have about 90 seconds left. I also was looking at the Texas Monthly newspaper. U.S. Border Patrol agents at the scene of a planned crowd control exercise that was to be conducted today near voting booths in El Paso. That's where Beto O'Rourke is from. Are now postponing the event to an unspecified day. Here you have troops, Border Patrol troops, carrying out crowd control exercises, announced exercises close to polling places in southern Texas. I mean, that's obviously designed for voter suppression.
Of course it is. And, you know, those we see those kinds of tactics all around the country. But I do want to mention for our listeners, in case they're not aware, there is really already, with the way the militarized border is and the border patrols down there, it is a heavily militarized climate down there, environment that makes it difficult for people who live in that area, you know, even on the U.S. side, to feel comfortable.
We're completely out of time. We were joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. They are the co-directors of Popular Resistance. You can go to their website, popularresistance.org. That's a must-stop if you want to become well-informed about what's happening in politics, both domestically and foreign policy. And we were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. Dave is an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. We have a lot more coming. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined this Tuesday, as we are every Tuesday in this segment, from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey, who is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
It's Election Day, Daniel. And of course, people in record numbers, perhaps, are going to the polls today. You can't say that there's not political engagement. Political engagement, political interest, political enthusiasm, it's everywhere. And it's on all sides. Democrats, Republicans, independents, it's everywhere. And so at the end of the day, by the end of tonight or by tomorrow, we'll know who's the leadership in the House of Representatives. Will it be the Democrats? Will the Republicans retain control? Same in the Senate. But, you know, one of the things that we wanted to talk with you about, because this segment takes up economy and economic issues, is just the amazing amount of money that's spent in the midterm elections. And we talk every election like this was a record. No election before this has ever seen this much money spent during the election campaign, until the next election campaign, when even more money is spent. And you can't come away from this, in spite of all of the engagement and enthusiasm, all of that involvement, without coming to the conclusion that the elections are also just a very, very big part of capitalist business opportunities for a significant sector of commercial entrepreneurs, including, of course, the media, but a whole class of consultants and people who have a thriving industry around elections.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, there's records here, record number of people coming out, record number of political engagement, and the record number of money spent, which, as you say, is consistently beat every new election cycle where the old record is busted and now we have a new one. The current record for this one is $5.2 billion, which is an absurd amount of money, probably more than most of our listeners can really conceive of. I mean, a billion just kind of sounds like a one with a whole lot of zeros behind it. It's hard to conceive of how much money that is. But what's been spent is about $5.2 billion on this election cycle to try to sway voters in various directions. And like you said, there's this huge industry of, oh, I don't know, you could call them maybe political marketers, but consultants and lobbyists and campaign managers, et cetera. And this money, you know, flows into their pockets as they seek to kind of influence public opinion by any means necessary. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that in this segment, because, you know, one of stories that we tell ourselves as U.S. Americans is that we live in a democracy and we get to choose our leaders and everybody gets to vote and everybody's treated equally. When the truth is, we look at spending and this amount of money is an essential part of the electoral process. And of course, those are who are able to spend more get to say more. So we might have free speech, although that's questionable. But we definitely don't have equality of speech. Sheldon Adelson, for example, who spent $110 million, he's a right-wing, you know, Zionist and racist, you know, spent $110 million. I'm pretty sure his voice is amplified far more than mine is on Loud and Clear, as much as I, you know, love this radio show.
No, it's not, Daniel. Your voice is louder than Sheldon Adelson in spite of his $113 million that he spent. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Brian. One can only hope. The truth is, though, that this sort of spending is typical and, in fact, necessary. One of the things they point out in a lot of the numbers is that the Democrats have currently raised about $310 million more than Republicans or so. They have a pretty good chunk lead in over the Republicans. And what that means is you look at the various races, they still remain close. But in general, the various tight races, the Democrats tend to be a little ahead, especially as they are spending more than their Republican competitors, which, you know, is to say something, because that means that money really matters and it does speak and it chooses people who will move policy decisions, who will make decisions that will affect millions of lives. And it looks like those decisions are being made essentially financially with the people who have the amount to spend on it. And I think we really need to talk more about the kind of systemic nature of it and how really, as different regulations and laws have been repealed, the ability to spend kind of unlimited amounts on whatever political issue you can afford is really more of the norm, and where billionaires and millionaires are allowed more and more monopoly control over the system because of their ability to essentially spend unlimited amounts of money and outspend, you know, the little guy who, you know, struggled to, well, could not even close to compete with some of them.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talk to him every Tuesday in this segment where we look at the big economic issues of the week or the day. Today is election day, so we're focusing, at least in our early part of this interview, on the role that money plays in the electoral process, and not just the role that it plays, the fact that it's a big business. Many local media outlets, Daniel, they premise their entire budgeting for the next 2 or 3 or 4 years even based on ad revenue that they take in during the election cycle. So you have Democrats, and just turn on your TV, anybody, the Democratic ads, they'll talk about how great their candidate is or how awful the Republican candidate is. And then like 1 second later, the other side's ad comes on. So ad matches ad. You have $5.2 billion spent just on midterm elections. We're not talking about the presidential election. I just looked up some comparable numbers. North Korea, Daniel, has a very significantly large military, especially for the size of North Korea. Of course, it's been technically at war since 1950. The North Korea annual defense budget, and I wanted to mention North Korea because it's always presented as this great threat to its neighbors and to America, etc. The entire defense budget of the DPRK, North Korea, is the same as what was spent in the midterm elections. It's just a couple $100 million more, $5.2 billion in the election cycle, just a couple $100 million more for the entire annual defense budget of the DPRK. Let's look at some of the Senate races where this money is being spent, this huge business that's called democracy. In Florida, the amount spent for the Senate race between Governor Rick Scott and incumbent Bill Nelson. Nelson is the Democrat. Scott is a Republican. The amount that they spent, everybody, is $181 million just for that one race. In Missouri, Claire McCaskill is running as a Democrat against her Republican challenger, Josh Hawley. How much was spent there? Missouri. We're talking about Missouri. One Senate seat. $118 million. And Texas, Daniel, everybody's talking about Texas because liberals like Beto O'Rourke and conservatives, I don't know if anybody could really like Ted Cruz, but they support Ted Cruz against Beto O'Rourke. That campaign has spent $107 million. Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat, has received 69 or no, maybe, yeah, $69 million for a Senate campaign. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz, poor Ted, or lying Ted, or as Donald Trump now calls him, beautiful Ted. Yes, that's what he calls him now. He spent a measly $37 million, so O'Rourke outspent him 2-1. But again, we're talking about $107 million spent on the Texas Senate race. I mean, those are just obscene amounts of money for people who are running for political office. And frankly, by the way, as excited as liberals are about Beto O'Rourke, which I understand it because people hate naturally Ted Cruz and his reactionary policies. But Beto O'Rourke, if he were to win, he'll find reasons to coddle up with Donald Trump, I believe, because he's in Texas. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the things we also need to talk about is how these various individuals are able to raise this massive amount of money, which means that they're backed by extremely wealthy people. So if we're making the connection that money, you know, equals votes, equals political power, that they're spending these hundreds of millions of dollars, who do you think they're thinking about or concerned with as they step into office, as they write policy, as they discuss legislature? They're certainly not concerned with me, who donated $35 or something like that, or, you know, some small amount. They're concerned with the very powerful billionaires who bankrolled, you know, the vast majority of this huge sum they've been given. And they need to remember that, because the next election cycle, if they don't kind of do what these corporate backers want them to do, then certainly they are going to not bankroll them the next time. And as we see, money buys votes. So they're, you know, not going to continue. So it's, you know, it's this vicious cycle. Even if, you know, and they're not, even if Beto O'Rourke was some kind of, you know, very progressive revolutionary character, even he couldn't seek to enact policies like that, because, of course, he wouldn't receive the backing needed to beat next time. He wouldn't receive the money he needs to do this. So it's systemic. The system ensures that so long as big money rules the politics, big business will rule the politics. And that's why they contribute to both sides. I think that's one thing we don't see, is that we try to divide this up and be, you know, say it's blue versus red and Democrat versus Republican and liberal versus conservative. But the truth is, most business interests actually contribute to both sides, because they want to ensure that whoever wins, they win. And they can say to that person, hey, I gave you X amount of millions of dollars to your campaign. Don't forget, you better do this. It's not an ideological thing. It's purely opportunistic, and it's, you know, purely about purchasing power. I think one thing that you also mentioned that's worth bringing up too is mainstream media, where, like you were saying, they plan, you know, years in advance for the money they're going to get to run these ad campaigns and run these different articles. You know, supposedly one of the stories we tell ourselves is we have this free press and they're allowed to say whatever they want, and their job is to ensure our politicians are accountable and, you know, are answerable for the things they do. But how can you really say that if their entire bankroll comes from political parties? How can you really say that, you know, the New York Times is independent if all their funding comes from Democrats and Democratic candidates? Are they really going to say bad things about the Democrats? Are they really going to expose corruption or lies or things like that in that political party? Of course not. And if they did, they'd swiftly go out of business, and then there'd be someone else to take the New York Times place, some sort of pro-Democrat publication. So we have to see that they want to have this big political theater of red versus blue and these very supposedly hugely contested, ideologically uncooperative views, when in fact they are really part of the same multi-billion dollar system where billionaires are able to put up money for their candidates and get them to, you know, do what they're going to do later and ensure that their interests are protected. And that's what we're seeing today. And also, one other thing I think that's really important to point out is, you know, the Democrats are raising all this record money on the back of the fact that Trump is horrible. And let's be clear, he is horrible. I mean, he's disgusting, xenophobe, sexist, racist. I mean, there's so many different reasons to dislike Donald Trump. They could mobilize millions, hundreds of millions of people on a campaign wanting to, say, legalize undocumented immigrants, or a campaign wanting to strengthen abortion rights or strengthen abortion access, or a campaign on universal health care. People would go bonkers over that. They would be in the streets. But you don't see that. What you see is the same sort of kind of neoliberal pseudo-conservatism that you saw from Hillary Clinton, which lost them a major presidential election. and them just riding on the hope that, well, Trump's so gross, people will vote for us no matter what, because how could they possibly? We just won't even touch his level of racism and disgust, rather than truly mobilizing people around real issues, which is not what you're seeing. Instead, you're just seeing record money being raised.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst in Northern California. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment of Loud and Clear, where we talk about the big economic issues of the day and of the week. Because today is election day, we're talking about the role of money in the elections, at least in the early part of this segment. Daniel, I want to go back. Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that allowed individual rich people and I believe corporations to give unlimited amounts of money vis-a-vis super PACs, political action committees, to support this or that candidate. That's had a lot of different kinds of impacts on the electoral process. And some of it's unintended. And I think some of it is, you know, I'd like to explore it for a second. And again, let's go through these list of donors, Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, very right wing. They gave $113 million so far for the midterm elections. Thomas Steyer and Catherine Taylor, they're liberals. They gave $50.7 million. Richard and Elizabeth Uhlhein, they gave $39 million. They're conservatives. Michael Bloomberg, they say liberal in this media report, which again means the word liberal has no meaning. Michael Bloomberg gave $38 million. Donald Sussman, liberal, $22 million. James Simons, liberal, $18 million. George Soros, liberal, $17 million. Stephen and Christine Schwartzman, $12.8 million, conservative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But how did Citizens United also skew the electoral process? Let's go back to 2016. Remember why Donald Trump actually won the Republican nomination? I believe, in addition to getting amazing amount, meaning billions of dollars of free press coverage from CNN and CBS and the other media outlets that later hated Donald Trump. In addition to that, there were 16 Republican candidates and none of them were getting out of the race, even though some of them only had 1 or 2 or 3% votes in the primaries. So the field didn't narrow. Thus, Donald Trump, who never had a majority support, but had a plurality, a significant plurality. His plurality dominated the Republican field. And the reason those 16 candidates could stay in the race, in spite of the fact that they were polling so badly in the primaries, which normally would mean they wouldn't have money. And if you didn't have money, you couldn't go on to the next primary. But because these individual billionaires had their own favorite sort of dog in the fight or horse in the race, they could keep funding these people no matter what. And as a consequence, it became a moneymaker for candidates who were getting almost no support to stay in the race so that their favorite billionaire backer would have a candidate. And then at the end of the day, they sort of folded their tent, most of them rallied behind Trump. But if it had been the good old days, which where money still dominated, but before Citizens United, those 16 candidates, that field would have winnowed down to like 5 or 6 pretty rapidly. And then Donald Trump's plurality, which never went above a certain number, I can't remember what it was, whether it was 35% or 40%, that would have shifted the dynamics within the Republican Party. Again, the unintended consequences of the Citizens United decision. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, one thing that we also need to mention that wasn't brought up is that Trump's victory was also tied heavily to this, you know, undemocratic process of electoral college voting and gerrymandering, which harkens back to the Civil War slave era, where, you know, the defeated slaveocracy was given outsized control and influence in government as a way of acquiescing and kind of pacifying them after they'd lost the war. So, you know, we can say Donald Trump did lose by millions of votes and yet was still the president, because that is what we, you know, consider democracy in our society. So I think it's important to point that out as well. But yes, one of the unintended consequences is that historically politicians have been able to act as kind of a buffer or a consultant between who really rules, you know, America, the banks, the corporations, the ultra rich, and then the supposedly public officials, right? The bureaucrats, the senators, et cetera, that run things. And you could be mad at them and you could blame them and point the finger at them and say, oh, they're, you know, terrible and doing a bad job. While their controllers, the people who fund them and who allow them to be in office, could quietly stand in the background and not receive any of the criticism. But what's happened because of Citizens United, because you can essentially just bankroll your own campaign if you feel like it, is that in many ways, corporations, the mask is off, and they're pushing those kind of handlers out of the way and taking the lead. So you have someone like Donald Trump, who the only reason he was able to run for this office is he had a lot of money. There was no other connections. He had no organic background in the bureaucracy of the United States. He had no real experience or anything like that. But boy, he was rich, and he was really good at getting airtime. He was pretty smart at how to manipulate media, how to take advantage of, you know, the reality TV world we live in. And he did a great job of it. And he also was very rich. So he was propelled to power. Since then, people have been talking about Oprah potentially running for office or Mark Zuckerberg running for office. People whose only credentials are that they have a lot of money. That has a destabilizing effect. Because what it does is it more clearly shows who's really in control and who's really running things and why. That these corporate powers are in control and that they're running things because they have a lot of money and they can afford it. This kind of starts to unseat the myth, the story that we have, which is that, you know, one person, one vote, and we're all in a democracy, and money doesn't, you know, control everything that even, you know, a street sweeper gets to weigh in on election day. That's more and more becoming a myth that we really can't maintain in our society, and that has a hugely destabilizing effect in things as people become more and more unsatisfied with the system as is, as they start seeing how much corporations control things and how much their wealth influences, you know, their day-to-day lives. So that was one of the unintended consequences. I mean, one of the points was to allow corporations to just dump whatever they wanted. But in many ways, you know, it gave them this not so much increased influence, but caused them to step into a role that historically they had not stepped in as directly. They had more been behind the scenes. And that remains to be seen exactly that, how that will play out. I think right now, though, what it's done is it's hugely delegitimized our political process. And the vast majority of people consider it kind of, you know, a joke, kind of a reality TV show that's run by money.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel, speaking of behind the scenes, I'm looking at a CBS News report, and this is a business report, and they're talking about the elections in a far, far different way than what most people who are going to the polls today, who want to vote, who think they're registering a political opinion, they're thinking about it in a far different way than, quote, the masses of people, close quote. I want to read a couple sentences and then get your take. The midterm elections are certain to have implications for Wall Street, regardless of how they shape the balance of power in Congress. That's because every scenario will create winners and losers in key sectors of the market, including banking, pharmaceuticals, companies that would benefit from government infrastructure projects, and those that rely on healthy consumer spending. The scenario deemed most likely by most recent polls and analyst projections has the Democrats regaining control of the House of Representatives and Republicans keeping control of the Senate. The odds are longer for Republicans or Democrats emerging with majorities in both chambers. Divided government equals gridlock, said Terry Haynes, head of U.S. policy and political analysts at Evercore ISI. Gridlock is a good thing for markets because markets like certainty. Now, that's a remarkable statement. Most people, when they elect a Congress, they think, oh, good, Congress will do something, like maybe make healthcare accessible to the people, maybe restore or rehabilitate the 70,000 bridges that are in disrepair and could fall down at any time, building other new infrastructure projects like high-speed trains to make for less congestion on the highways, to do things to make life easier for working moms, maybe to do something to provide childcare for those families that desperately need childcare because childcare is so unaffordable for so many families. None of that would happen in a gridlock Congress. And yet what this report from CBS is suggesting is that's precisely what would be best for corporate America and for the banks.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about it. Investors do like stability. Imagine remember how much consternation there was about all the tariffs on China. That wasn't supposed to happen. Their capital was supposed to flow freely and easily between China and the U.S. and anywhere else it wanted to go. And when it started to get restricted through those tariffs, then you started to see them speak up. You saw a lot of market instability. Stock prices were everywhere, going up, going down, crashing suddenly, then bouncing back up because of all the instability. Gridlock is very bad for people. It prevents us from getting the necessary changes and benefits that we need in our society. But gridlock is great for corporations because right now, as it stands, in spite of the dissatisfaction and unhappiness with the people, corporations more or less run things. They more or less rule, you know, the United States and much of the world. And they would love to keep it that way. So gridlock means it stays that way. I also think there's more you can pick apart in the article. They try to talk about the different outcomes. You know, if Democrats win both the House and the Senate, or if they win just one, or if Republicans retain control of both, how that's going to look. And one of the things I thought was a little, dishonest is it says a Democrat-led House could also lead to heightened oversight and investigation of big banks and Wall Street firms, which could weigh on financial sector stocks. Now, CBS News is, you know, more or less a pro-Democratic party platform. That, to me, is kind of laughable. I mean, when you think about the 2008 crisis, who bailed out the banks? That was a heavily democratically controlled government with a Democratic president who was very popular, who had a lot of popular grassroots mobilization and support behind him. And that was the party that completely bailed out the banks and sold out, you know, taxpayers to the tunes of trillions of dollars. And yet what they're trying to say somehow is imply that Democrats are going to be tougher on banks and Wall Street firms because, I don't know, I guess that's just their moral imperative or something like that. So I also wanted to point that out. I think that, you know, either way, investment firms would love gridlock. But the same banks and investment firms have also given a lot of money to Democratic candidates as well as Republican ones. And whether they win both or win one, they're going to know that they're going to be there to say, hey, remember, I gave you X amount of dollars. You better do what we need. So they're going to get taken care of regardless. And that is ultimately because whether it's a Republican party or a Democratic party that remains in control or both, what will remain in control is capitalism. And that is what allows these corporations to profit. They just have different ideas of what sort of capitalism they want, how they want to manage the contradictions of the capitalist system. They're going to fight about that. They're going to have arguments about that. But overall, what they're all going to come around is, yes, capitalism and more capitalism, whether it's Democrat or Republican.
Right, indeed. Let's think for a second. Let's imagine what a Democratic election system would look like. It would basically be to remove money from the equation altogether. Maybe there would be like a government fund that would say, okay, each candidate gets XYZ number of dollars. That's it. You don't have any more than that to spend. We're going to make sure that money is a relatively non-factor. This exists in other countries. This isn't completely novel. I know Americans think that money in politics must be divinely mandated. The word of God, the 11th commandment or something like that. But it's not. And in other countries, there are different ways that elections take place. In some countries, no advertising is allowed whatsoever. Television advertising. Anyway, why not go in that direction? Because certainly removing the business element of these elections, which are designed really to basically, as the CBS News said, make sure what's good for the banks, what's good for the pharmaceuticals, what's good for agribusiness, what's good for oil companies. Like, those are not the things that working class people, and by working class people, I mean people who are middle class, who are working, people who have a lower income, people who have almost no income, that large mass of the working population in America that must work in order to live is not living off of property, not coupon clippers, in other words. They don't need to have a system run by and for money. The government, the government we are told as kids is of, by, and for the people. And when you have this much money, $5.2 billion again in the midterm elections, that's not of, by, and for the people. That's not democracy. That is a plutocracy of, by, and for wealth. 2 minutes left, Daniel Sankey. There are other ways.
There are absolutely other ways, and we can look to a lot of different countries to see how they decide to manage this. Part of it is capping spending. Another thing is getting everyone equal access to media and airtime so that the different candidates can stand up and speak. Another one is equal ballot access, where candidates are all on there and allowed to put forth a platform and opinion and people can vote on them. Many states, like mine, for example, many, many contenders are left off the ballot. They simply can't be on it. Furthermore, you have to pay to put a statement on the ballot, and each word costs money. And if you can't afford all the words, then your statement is significantly shorter or non-existent. There are many, many little peculiar ways we have to force people to spend more money on these things. And there's no reason to necessarily have it. The problem with that is we talk about that gridlock. That gridlock would largely go away. People would be able to actually change things. What if we allowed everyone to vote by mail? What if we allowed everybody to vote online through some kind of secure system? There's many ways to give people access to it, which right currently, what, we have a voting day on Tuesday when everybody's at work anyway? That's crazy. You know, people have jobs.
And in November, where it's cold and rainy all around the country right now, storming, I mean, why not have several multiple days of voting in a time period, a seasonal time period where it's probably not going to be storming, where it's not going to be raining and with cold, heavy rain or snow? And why not make sure that people have the day off and everyone has the absolute right to vote no matter what? I mean, that would be such a minimal expansion of, it would be a major expansion of democracy, but it would take a minimal effort. It's not like an uprising or an armed revolution. It would be simply the expansion of democracy. But the powers that be, including the people who make so much money and have turned elections into this giant, vast business, they actually don't want that. They're pretty content with the way the system works.
Absolutely. There is a lot of very wealthy people who would lose control. I mean, I think one thing that we need to point out is just really briefly, John Adams talked about how his fear of democracy was that the poor who are many would take all the wealth from those who are the wealthy who are few. And that was one of the big problems with democracy, and he wanted to see it managed. And since then, our governments have been.
Yeah, American democracy solved that problem. Anyway, that was Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talk to him every Tuesday in this weekly segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.